Great. Sensational. Terrific. What is it?
I told you.
Cybercrimeology.
Are you with me?
Not exactly with you, but somewhere nearby.
Oh.
This is Cybercrimeology, a podcast about cybercrime, its research, and its researchers. My name is Michael, and I think it goes without saying that the police are an important part of the cybercrime equation. Law enforcement is a large, complex, and global set of institutions, and it can be difficult for large institutions to adapt to big changes in the environment, like the internet. So how are they doing? Our guest today is Dr. Michael Wilson from Murdoch University in Australia, who, with colleagues, has recently looked into this question in Australia in the paper Police Preparedness to Respond to Cybercrime in Australia, an Analysis of Individual and Organisational Capabilities, which was published in the Journal of Criminology. I'll let you know now that Vanessa Henri will join us again this episode to candidly answer another of my reckless questions about the practice of cyber lawyering. So make sure you stay around for that. First, though, I was curious as to how Dr. Wilson got to doing studies working with the police, because his publishing history suggests a start more interested with privacy.
You could even go further back, and you can see my most cited article is about human trafficking policy. I got very interested in surveillance legislation, particularly digital surveillance and privacy rights, which is what my PhD was ostensibly about. And through that, I got very interested in the problem of going dark and sort of the ethics of encryption, which is part of what my current research is about that. And then analogous to that, digital evidence management, cybercrime policing. And the way I think about my current research themes, you know, it's okay, cybercrime policing, data and algorithmic justice. So within that, I sort of include the questions of data protection, privacy rights, digital surveillance, and then questions about platform governance and digital constitutionalism. So how should we regulate the internet? So I still see all of those things as connected. But yes, it was definitely a journey to discovering sort of cybercrime as one of my areas of interest.
I guess you could kind of draw a line from questions about going dark to, are the police actually capable of finding people in the dark?
Yes, exactly. I like the work of Kevin Haggerty and the techno fixes to crime problems. So because police, often because of many of the same problems that impact us as academics, you know, they've got KPIs, they've got budget restrictions, they need quick fixes to crime problems. Ah, technology, this is going to be our savior. We can bring in the metadata retention scheme. We can build in a backdoor into encryption. It'll make our job easier, less manpower needed, less resources, less analysts, less data analysts, for example, and less intelligence analysts necessary to do the job. We can automate all this. So that was sort of the journey to getting into this. And the history of this paper, I'm happy to sort of go into it, is it started off as an AIC grant that Cass, Tom, and Anna put in. And I came in as a research assistant initially to help out with the data collection. And then I just sort of became part of the research team.
I guess it's good to keep an open mind when you're looking for opportunities.
Yes. Look, and it's that tension again, right? We need to be specialists. We need to specialize in something very specific to sort of make our name in the field. But I'm just interested in technology and criminal justice. I find all this stuff really interesting. And maybe it's a slight ADHD of the brain or something, but I want to keep doing research on all these things because, and maybe I just talk myself into a circle, but I see them as all connected. And when I teach my students in my sort of tech crime and justice unit, we go through what cybercrimes are, policing of cybercrime, and then we shift into questions about platform governance and digital constitutionalism, talking about a broader understanding of social control in cyberspace, because policing is one component of that bigger question. So I see all these things as being sort of intimately connected. I've always liked big questions in social science and criminal justice. I like the big questions, and for research purposes, I'm often pulled towards really narrow questions, but I think those big questions are important to keep your eye on, I suppose. A lot of the times they're questions you can't answer with a research project. But the big questions like, how is technology changing crime and justice? I mean, that's not a research question. That's a research theme. But I think it's really interesting to open a conversation and go down all the different rabbit holes that it leads you to.
So in terms of the police, what was the big question that got you started and opened the door to this research?
This particular project began as a Australian Institute of Criminology grant that, as I said, my colleagues Cassandra Cross, Tom Holt, and Anastasia Powell put in. And they initially, because I was a PhD student at the time, they wanted to sort of address some of the dearth of research that existed, particularly in the Australian context around cybercrime policing. Thomas Holt, obviously one of the leaders in that area, he'd done research already in the United States and the United Kingdom around this particular topic. You know, he'd been doing that research since 2012, I think he did the initial paper. So we had this data set about how American and British police view cybercrime, their confidence in their capabilities, and the confidence that they had or lack thereof in their institutions. But we didn't have analogous data in Australia. And given that there'd been this focus in Australia about the importance of cybersecurity, it started to pop up as a social problem that was being spoken about by lawmakers within the media. Initially, Cass, Tom, and Anna realized, like, hey, we need some data in the Australian context. And I was brought in to help with the data collection. I have a sort of mixed methods research background, very comfortable doing both quantitative and qualitative research, of which this project was collecting. We did both a community survey, a police survey, and then we also did qualitative data collection through focus groups with law enforcement officers and other justice professionals. Basically, the idea was, okay, we want to understand the current landscape of perceptions of cybercrime in Australia and the capabilities of law enforcement to address the cybercrime problem. We collected the quantitative data first, but we did the community survey. We surveyed about 2,500 Australian residents. We surveyed, I think in total, it was about 600 police officers across four different jurisdictions. Of course, this paper, we used two jurisdictions because they were the ones with the most respondents that we had. And then we took that quantitative data, we did some preliminary analyses, and we presented the preliminary results to the focus groups and got the qualitative data. Because from the outset of the project, it was, okay, what are the perceptions? What are the problems? How can we fix these problems? So it was very much so geared towards trying to develop criminal justice policies in the cybercrime prevention disruption area, and then not just the generation of knowledge. We did want to have a sort of practical element from the beginning. And that fed into, you know, there is a broader AIC project report that summarizes a lot of the data. We're still writing up some of the publications that are going along. And so this particular paper, the one in the Journal of Criminology, specifically looked at how prepared are Australian police to respond to this problem, given that it has become such an important social and political issue for Australians, given the fact that we're seeing more and more data breaches affecting Australians, given that there has been a significant increase in both government resources to try and address the problem through initially bringing in the Australian Cybercrime Online Reporting Network, which is a centralized reporting database, which has now been renamed to Report Cyber. So they've been putting in some of this resource. There's a lot of talk, but there just wasn't any information.
The data you collected, you asked a number of questions. How do Australian police, at least from the ones you surveyed, how do they fit into the international picture of policing cybercrime?
From our data, the Australian police were comparatively more confident in both their own capabilities to respond to cybercrime incidents and also more confident in their organization's capabilities compared to the analogous data from the United Kingdom and the United States. Now, one caveat about that is that our data was collected at least 3-4 years after the UK data and 6 to 7 years after the US data. So we cannot say for certain that it is a function of, say, the Australian cybercrime training that is now being embedded into the police academies in most jurisdictions. We cannot say for certain that that is why they were comparatively more confident. It could have just been that we're collecting data at a later time and the American and British police may very well be at the same levels of confidence. With that said, Australian police were still not overwhelmingly confident in either their own capabilities or the capabilities of their policing organizations to respond to cybercrime confidently. We saw that 53% of our surveyed personnel were at least somewhat confident. So we measured confidence on a 5-point scale, so not at all confident through to very confident. The middle point was somewhat confident. At least 53% were at least somewhat confident, but only 5% were very confident in their own capabilities. And only 12% were confident in their capabilities. So they feel somewhat confident, but they do not express a really significant amount of confidence. And you know, when we collected the data, we collected information about how confident they were in terms of general responses, but also how confident they were with specific skills. So how confident are you with preserving a digital crime scene, with preserving digital evidence? How confident are you with receiving a complaint from a victim of cybercrime? And you know, the more specific the skill set, the less confidence they tend to express. The other aspect of this was we compared their individual levels of confidence compared to organizational confidence. Generally, officers were more confident in their own capabilities than in their organizations, which probably isn't surprising because, you know, people tend to have more insight into their own capabilities compared to the capabilities of an entire organization. And large organizations like police tend to be pretty messy and complex. So we actually saw a majority of the surveyed were not confident in their organizations at all. So 53% weren't confident at all, and only 1% were very confident. So there was a bit of a lukewarm perception of how well equipped the Australian police agencies were to respond to this increasing problem.
And what would you say that perception was down to?
I think it's got to do with internal mechanisms for the most part. Now, we didn't collect any data around that to answer that particular question. That wasn't one of the research questions for our project, but Thomas Holt and some of his colleagues have looked into that particular question in the international literature. And it seems to come down to how logical, how well planned the internal processes of policing organizations are. Do they have a clear policy around cybercrime? Is there a clear procedure that all officers have access to about what they should do if someone comes to report a cybercrime to them? So it's about how well functioning the organizations are, and as well, how much priority is cybercrime given in the ordinary functioning of the organization? So are the managers talking about it? Is it spoken about at meetings in the various different units within the organization? So those features seem to be important, at least according to the literature that has been done in the US and the UK, or the extant research in the US and the UK.
A lot of the finger pointing from outside of police organizations is at a lack of training. Did they feel like they were well trained, or did they somewhat agree with that assessment?
It was fairly similar to their confidence level. So we did measure the prevalence of cybercrime training among the officers, and only about 49% reported receiving any training whatsoever in cybercrime. Now, bearing in mind that the data was collected a couple of years ago, and based upon anecdotal evidence, you know, conversations with the police academies in Australia, it does seem like they are beginning to embed it more in the police academy and trying to upskill the officers. But at the time we collected this data, only 49% had reported any type of cybercrime related training. And again, that number goes down the more specific you get. So if you're talking about training about how to refer a victim of cybercrime to the appropriate reporting agency, which in Australia is Report Cyber, it goes down to 31%. If you're talking about training to preserve digital evidence, it goes down to 27%. And you know, if you're training about what are the relevant state and federal legislation in this space in Australia, because you know we've got the two levels of government both legislate in this area, it's down to 18%. And then specific digital investigative techniques, it was only 18%. Now, there's going to be a division of labor in these organizations. It makes sense that not all general duties officers need to know digital investigative techniques. It is completely reasonable that only 18% perhaps have been trained in that space. However, there are some skill sets that general duties officers, as the first responders to a lot of cybercrime incidents, should be equipped with. For example, basic knowledge around digital evidence preservation is important, I think, for general duties officers to have. Basic knowledge about how to refer a victim complainant to the appropriate reporting agency in a particular jurisdiction, that's very important for the first responders to a crime scene to know about. And that was a bit concerning to us as the research team when we were seeing that, okay, only about 20% of the officers have received training in those spaces. But when we're thinking about how this project really needs to identify the problems to help us also then identify the solutions in this space, then yes, I think a lot of the external criticism that has been made that we need more training, I think it's borne out by our data. There is definitely a need for training But we need to think about what specific training is needed by what aspects of these organizations. General duties officers need a specific type of training. Specialist investigators, perhaps in, you know, working in a fraud squad or something like that, need a specific type of training because they're going to be handling digital evidence as well. They're going to be dealing with cyber fraud offenses. And then your digital forensic analysts working in tech crime units are going to need a different type of training and continuous ongoing education so they can maintain their skills. So we need to think about, okay, it's not just more training. It's, yes, more training, but specific types of training, depending on what type of personnel we're talking about.
What training and for whom?
Yes.
Anything that happens on the internet is probably happening on a computer owned by somebody somewhere. So there's always the engagement of private institutions. How do the police feel about working with private institutions?
In the paper, we do talk about the perceptions of the surveyed personnel, what their preferred cybercrime policy solutions might be. And generally speaking, the officers were supportive of cooperating with external organizations, including private sector, you know, technology companies for the most part. 61% of the surveyed personnel thought it was very important to cooperate with technology companies in order to police the internet. They thought it was a little bit less important to work closely with businesses that had been victims of cyber crimes that might perhaps be operating a service on the internet, where only 38% thought that that was an important policy response. So the officers generally do think that they need to be cooperating with the Googles, the Facebooks of the world, or the Metas of the world, in order to police, to govern, to regulate cyberspace effectively. And, you know, I think that that gets down to, you know, you said cyberspace is private. I think it, for the most part, it is very much so private. You know, web pages, social media platforms, these are privately owned platforms. They're not, you know, as much as, and I'll be topical here, as much as Elon Musk claims that Twitter is the modern day public sphere, it is a privately owned platform where that conversation is taking place.
Very much so as a result of his actions.
Yes, very, very much so. I think we're seeing that being borne out in the ways in which that platform is being governed right now. So these private organizations have the most amount of power in terms of influencing the behaviors of users, have the most amount of power in the ability of collecting evidence about cybercrime offences, for example. And then you've also got not just the platforms themselves, you've got internet service providers, telecommunications service providers who are collecting absolutely massive amounts of data about people's online browsing behaviours. And police, you know, by virtue of the fact, particularly when you're talking about like Australian police agencies, there's so much data, there are difficulties with governing citizens who are using cyberspace and interacting with people across different jurisdictions. That I think this is my intuition, and we didn't ask police officers about this, but the way I am sort of interpreting that result is that police are a little bit out of their depth in trying to regulate cyberspace because there's not enough personnel. There's not enough personnel with adequate knowledge or training about how computers, computer networking works, and sort of the sociology of social media as well, and the ways in which human behavior is influenced by technology. There aren't enough officers equipped to adequately respond to these problems without collaborating with those private institutions, the private owners of those cyberspaces. So, yes, I think they do see it as an important aspect of their job because I think it's the only way that they can effectively regulate those spaces.
I think what you mentioned about their feelings about their capacity to deal with cybercrime is interesting. And I'll put forward a scenario here, and you can tell me how close to something realistic you think this is. If perceptions of efficacy are based on experience and you don't feel that you're able to do something, you're probably unlikely to attempt it. With cybercrime, if you don't feel like your own organization will effectively deal with cybercrime, if someone complains about cybercrime to you, you might push them away to a different organization that you feel is more capable of dealing with it. But then you don't get experience in actually seeing your organization effectively deal with it. And because of that, you're more likely to not deal with it. And then this sort of vicious cycle is created.
I definitely do. And I think that there is data to back that up. Again, in some of the other literature in this space, previous experiences with responding to cybercrimes strongly correlate with heightened confidence in both an individual officer's ability to respond to cybercrime and confidence in their organization to respond to cybercrime. And again, a lot of the work of Tom Holt looks into that. And we also touch upon that in this particular article, you know, the previous exposures, the most, how recently an officer has been exposed to a cybercrime incident. We sort of had a look at the effect of that on confidence as well. I do think it is absolutely a problem because the general duties officers are not getting exposed to this at the perhaps the same rate as the landscape of crime is changing. Most crime is still what you might characterize as terrestrial. Now, a lot of people talk about how cybercrime is increasing, you know, and I'm guilty of this in my own publications. You know, it's becoming an increasing problem. The bread and butter of most general duties officers' work is still, you know, dealing with terrestrial issues, dealing with crimes occurring in physical space. But we are still seeing an increase in cybercrime incidents. And I think that is going to have to become an increasing part of the work of general duties officers. Now, in a jurisdiction like Australia and the various states, cybercrime is highly centralized and managed in a very centralized way. And that may indeed be feeding into the low or lukewarm levels of confidence we're seeing among particularly general duties officers. If someone comes to your local police station and you know, brings their phone and says, look, I'm being harassed, I'm being stalked on Instagram, you know, the general duties officers, theoretically, their responsibility is to report or to refer the complainant to report to the centralized reporting agency. And they'll do that purely through the internet. And that report gets received by the agency. They will assess it, and then they will forward it on to the relevant agency, whether that is the state-based police or the AFP, the Australian Federal Police. And so it all happens sort of behind a screen. The general duties officers don't ever get any experience with that. If they are treating it like a cybercrime, you know, it is very possible that they may treat it as a traditional harassment offence. They may action it in that way. But the way in which the system is set up is perhaps undermining the capabilities of general duties officers to learn those on-the-job skills to the same extent that perhaps we need them to, if we want to get them upskilled to the necessary level. Training is obviously one important aspect, but on-the-job learning, I think, is very, very important as well. Caveat to all this is that the reason why that centralized reporting agency was brought in was to try and improve reporting rates, to encourage victims to come forward so that their complaints could be taken seriously and would be looked at by someone who has the necessary knowledge to make an assessment as to whether or not that should be forwarded on to a relevant unit in a state-based police agency. So it's a bit of a balancing act, I suppose, here. But I do think that the general duties officers should be learning more on the job as well.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much for your time, and I look forward to the next paper.
Thank you very much, Michael.
If you're involved in cyber, then you're often expected to answer questions on everything from the difference between USB 3 and USB 4 to what a purchase really means for subscription software. The best way to get ahead of those wild questions is to ask an expert, and we happen to have cornered a cyber lawyer. Vanessa Henry is a co-founder at Henry & Wolf, an adjunct professor, an advisor on numerous boards, and a well-sought-after speaker. But more importantly, she's patient, she's willing to answer my dumb questions, so let's take advantage of that, and we'll ask it this. Do we have good laws? Are there such thing as bad laws? And what can we do about it?
I would say it's very rare that everybody just votes to have a bad law. Usually what happens is either that there's a law that's been amended over time, and the sum of the amendments end up not making sense. We kind of lost the essence of the law, or we start with a little something, then we want to squeeze it by adding things over time. And what happens is that, you know, that fragile balance that has justified the law in the first place doesn't seem to be there. And that's the role of constitutional lawyers. That's why you can contest the constitutionality of laws. And I mean, Quebec is going to have its fair share of that debate in the next few months. But, you know, that's why you can contest the law. But I would say, at the very least, I have rarely saw people vote law out of bad faith. That's usually not what happened. But the issue is some laws nowadays are more reactive than they used to be. And it's always a problem when you pass a law to react to something, obviously. We would prefer to have, you know, long time thinking about the laws. And I would say that, you know, technology brings its unique challenge when we vote laws because it changed so quickly that you can't really address each technology. So you need to address them to kind of a metaphysical manner where you say, okay, be reasonable, don't discriminate. So I would laws tend to rely on naturally occurring values in most of the cases. And I know some people may disagree right now. But the vast majority of law started with values we all agree with. Where it gets more problematic is when we try to have some very specific regulations on what can or cannot be done, then it's easy to fall into something that people don't agree with or is not aligned with the technical requirements or the reality or operational requirements of where the law is being applied. And that's where you can risk having a bad law because the law doesn't work and it's just asking people to spend a lot of money to do something that is outdated. So this is what we want to be very careful about. But down the line, the lawyer's job is not to do the laws. And I think people get confused a lot with that. That sometimes I have people get angry at me because of a law. And I say, well, I didn't write it and I didn't vote it either. I said, if anything, you voted it, not me. You're the one who goes to vote, you know. And these politicians are writing it, voting it. And then there's a number of processes before a law is adopted and a number of committee. And there's usually opportunities for people to go and express their disagreement with the law. And only a few people I know have ever done this. Most people just let the process go and then turn around and blame lawyers. I say, well, I don't have anything to do with that. The job of the lawyer is actually to take your interest and apply the law. And if the law doesn't make sense and it's not good for your interest and it's actually something that is affecting you negatively and appears to be in violation of the Charter of Rights and Freedom and other type of constitutional law, then we may decide that we put a claim for you. But down the line, lawyers and the enactment of laws have nothing to do together. Now, I'll agree with you that politicians are often individuals who were lawyers before. And I think that has a lot to do with being able to write the law, understand them and vote on them. But these are two different professions, just as much as journalism and law is. It's very often the case we share a common background. And that's because law is one of these studies you can do that will bring you anywhere you want to go. Yeah, there's people who are doing legal translation. There's people who are doing paralegals. Others are doing cyber laws, others are doing family laws. There's even international negotiation. I know somebody who's doing hostage negotiation as well, ransomware negotiation. I don't actually think I know two lawyers who are doing the same thing. I don't think I know. And every time you think you're specialized, there's going to be somebody more specialized than you or even over-specialized into something you didn't even know it was possible to specialize into. So down the line, there's not good or bad laws, and lawyers and politicians and journalists are not all the same people. It's, I think, more complex than this, and we have to be careful when we express our concern that we don't make this leap of faith where we put everything in the same basket, because it just brings more obscurity to why is the law not working out for me, where we as lawyer have to bring clarity for that and explain the process and explain to people what they can do and how they can express themselves and what the law truly says. There's unfortunately a lot of misinformation around the legal field and around the laws. Like you'll see a lot in the news, like, oh, we passed this law that says this. And I can tell you 3 times out of 5, that's not what the law says at all. And so you're wondering who wrote this and why didn't you ask a lawyer at this place? Just as many times as I hear, it's the lawyer's fault where we have nothing to do with voting the laws.
Thank you, Vanessa. And thanks as well to Dr. Wilson for sharing his research with us. There are, of course, links to the paper in the show notes. Thank you for listening, and I hope you are staying safe and you're only stressing a little bit. And until the next episode, this has been Cybercrimeology, a podcast about cybercrime, its research, and its researchers. It's produced by me, but it's only really made possible by the kind guests who share their time and their research. You can find out more about the show at cybercrimeology.com, and you can talk to me at cybercrimeology on Twitter.